found in the Streus.
Congratulations, you've made it.
Hi, this is David Einstein. I'm going to read the post Differences in the Intensity of Valenced Experience Across Species by Jason Shoecraft from the EA Forum. I read the summary of this post in a previous reading episode, and that took me quite some time. I chucked in a few comments there. This one is going to take me a massive amount of time. It claims it's a 119 minutes read, and it usually takes me a lot longer than the stated time to actually read it. I will try to limit my comments and explainers here, as I said in the other episode, because this is something I don't know a great deal about. Okay, without the further ado, as I said, Difference in the Intensity of Valenced Experience Across Species by Jason Shoecraft, 29 October 2020, 83 upvotes, 36 comments, tags Moral Weight, Pain and Suffering, Rethink Priorities, Forum Prize, Valence, Moral Patienthood, Animal Sentience, Farmed Animal Welfare, Wild Animal Welfare, front page post. Key highlights. This will probably recap what I mentioned in the previous reading of the summary. Differences in the intensity range of valenced experience across species may affect how we ought to allocate resources to help different types of animals. Humans, these are bullet points. Humans and other mammals likely share a roughly similar intensity range. It is unlikely that any species of animals possesses an intensity range that is exclusively extraordinarily mild. Some aspects of cognitive sophistication appear to be positively correlated with intensity range. Other aspects of cognitive sophistication appear to be negatively correlated with intensity range. Affective complexity, generally appears to be positively correlated with intensity range. And final bullet point, there is as yet no good objective measure of valence intensity, though there is much interesting work ongoing in this area. Executive summary. This post is the fifth in Rethink Priorities Moral Weight series. In this report, I explain why it would matter if different sorts of animals possessed characteristically different intensity ranges of valenced experience. What factors might affect the intensity range of valenced experience, and how we might begin to measure differences in the intensity of valenced experience. Animals differ in their perceptual abilities, their psychology and neural architecture, and their cognitive, affective, and social complexity. Given these differences, it would be surprising if the intensity range of valenced experience were uniform across species. To investigate differences in the intensity range of valenced experience across species, I adopted a three-stage methodology. First, I explored what, if anything, theoretical evolutionary biology could tell us about the function of valenced experience. Next, I explored how different aspects of intellectual and emotional complexity might affect the characteristic intensity of valenced experience. Finally, I explored potential neurobiological, behavioral, and physiological markers of the intensity of valenced experience in humans and non-human animals. That did take my brain a moment or two to digest, so I'll just comment on what I think it means. So the first, he considers what evolutionary biology may have to say about the function of valenced experience. I've heard discussions of this before. In other words, well, he's about to get to it. So to promote fitness and proven behaviors, evolution will select me for having a range of experiences that will get me or convince me to do things that will favor my reproduction and the reproduction of people with similar or animals with similar genes to me. So that's the sort of idea behind the theoretical evolutionary biology explanation. The next, he talks about different aspects of emotional and intellectual complexity and how that might affect the characteristic intensity of valenced experience. I'm not sure what he means by that. I guess we'll get to it. Why would intellectual complexity affect valenced experience? Maybe if I'm a deeper person, I can experience these feelings more intensely or maybe less intensely if I can know to put it in perspective, just brainstorming here. Characteristic intensity, I guess he means typical intensity. So of our more emotionally and intellectually complex beings, do they tend to, I guess is what he means, have more intense or greater range of intensity of valence, of valenced experience, as in positive, negative experience, of course. And then the third one is potential markers, neurobiological behavior and physiological markers. I guess what he's referring to there, again, I'm not an expert, but I assume what he's referring to there is something about how can we measure observe this. That is, what things would we expect to vary in an observable way in line with greater intensity of valenced experience. Broadly speaking, the evolutionary function of valenced experience is to promote fitness-improving behaviors. It's plausible that natural selection would not produce animals for whom valenced experiences were always extraordinarily weak, because subjective experiences that were so faint as to be almost imperceptible would appear to do a poor job motivating behavior. Conversely, it appears unlikely that evolution would select for animals with a non-contiguous range that was exclusively extraordinarily strong, because extremely intense experiences are distracting in a way that appears likely to reduce fitness. So he's saying that the range of experiences are not going to be so small that you can't tell whether things are good or bad, because then you won't know whether to do the things you're supposed to or not do and avoid the things you're supposed to avoid. And he also doesn't think it's going to be sort of, for any species or individuals, just incredibly, either incredibly bad or incredibly good. That's what he means by, I guess, by a non-continuous range, because that's going to somehow, the intense experiences are going to be distracting and maybe make it harder for you to make decisions and act in a day-to-day way. Quote, cognitive sophistication is a nebulous term that may refer to any of a constellation of mostly independent traits. Many of these traits plausibly affect the intensity of valenced experience, but the sign of the effect is often unclear. Quote, affective complexity, unquote, refers to the diversity and depth of emotional sensations an animal can experience. Increased affective complexity may unlock qualitatively unique emotional states, such as fear, depression, or love, that by themselves or in combination with physical states, increase the intensity range of experience. There are currently no good cross-species measures of the intensity of valenced experience, though there is intriguing recent evidence that neural oscillations in the gamma band may track differences in pain intensity in both humans and non-human mammals. Humans and non-human mammals possess neurologically and behaviorally similar affective systems, suggesting that most mammals are capable of experiencing roughly the same base set of emotions. It's unclear how stark the difference in cognitive sophistication the differences are across all mammalian species, and how these differences might affect the intensity of valenced experience. Given these facts, it would appear that we are more justified in thinking that humans possess an intensity range roughly similar to other mammals than we are in thinking that humans possess a much wider range than other mammals. It is unclear how mammals compare to other groups of animals, in part because there is a much sparser scientific literature on the capabilities of non-mammals, and in part because it is unclear how increasing phylogenetic distance ought to increase reasoning by analogy about subjective experience. Here, there's a quick blurb of where this fits into the moral weight series. So the moral weight series This is the fifth of them. First was comparisons of capacity for welfare and moral status across species. The second, how to measure capacity for welfare and moral status. Third, the subjective experience of time, welfare implications. Four, does critical flicker fusion frequency track the subjective experience of time? And then finally, here we are, difference in intensity of valenced experience across species. The first one looks particularly interesting, having to do with moral status. I might want to come back to that one. Okay, next section.
Intensity
of valenced experience and its range. Valenced experiences are those experiences that take on positive or negative phenomenal affect. Take on positive or negative phenomenal affect. That is, valenced experiences are those experiences that feel good or feel bad to the subject. The intrinsic value of an experience is the product of its parentheses possibly subject relative duration and valenced intensity. I'll say that again. The intrinsic value of an experience is the product of its parentheses possibly subject relative duration and its valenced intensity. So he means that multiply those two things together. Just as the duration of experiences varies, so too does the valenced intensity of experiences. Some pains hurt worse than others. A sprained wrist is typically less wrenching than a broken femur. Some pleasures are better than others. An evening watching television typically engenders less joy than the birth of one's first child. Human life contains an assortment of valenced experiences. Some experiences, like the birth of one's child, may be profoundly positive. Other experiences, like breaking one's femur, may be acutely negative. Taking the difference of one's best experience and one's worst experience gives us one's realized intensity range of valenced experience. Of course, the average human probably doesn't experience the highest possible highs and lowest possible lows, I guess for any human. Most of us do not have the misfortune of, say, suffering torture in a prisoner of war camp. Neither, though, do most of us taste the pure jubilation of, say, scoring the winning point in a sports championship. Taking the difference of the best experience one might undergo and the worst experience one might undergo gives us one's possible intensity range of valenced experience. So realized and possible. And next he introduces some other terms. Characteristic range versus possible range. I put a little side comment here that I think he's maybe going a little too much into these definitions. It feels a little bit like a digression, but maybe I'm wrong. Because maybe this is really very relevant to the literature and what's going to be discussed next. Characteristic range versus possible range. In addition to realized range and possible range, there's a third conception of valence intensity range that's useful for our purposes. An animal's characteristic intensity range of valenced experience is defined by those experiences that are common for a member of the animal species at a particular point in the history of the species. Characteristic range is still a modal notion because it is independent of an animal's actual experiences. It's possible that an animal's actual experiences exclusively fall outside the characteristic range. One potential reason to be more concerned about the characteristic range than the possible range is that animals might differ much more in their characteristic than their possible range, which would be especially concerning if inducing intensities outside the characteristic range were much more challenging than inducing intensities within the characteristic range. If this is the case, Then, for practical purposes, when deciding how to allocate resources to different species, it might be more informative to look at characteristic rather than possible range. An example will illustrate the point. Suppose it's possible, though very difficult, for both pigs and chickens to reach intensities as low as negative 100 and as high as positive 100. Suppose as well that the characteristic of range of pigs is negative 90 to positive 90, and the characteristic range of the chickens is negative 10 to positive 10. Suppose, finally, that moving an animal from one point outside its characteristic range, one point outside its characteristic range is 10 times as costly as moving an animal one point inside its characteristic range. In this scenario, focusing too much on possible as opposed to characteristic range might lead us to allocate equal resources to pigs and chickens, even though, given the assumptions and all else equal, it will usually be more cost-effective to help pigs rather than chickens in this scenario. More generally, differences in possible range that are rarely realized may matter less than differences in characteristic range that are often realized. Just wanted to comment here that I found the example a little bit puzzling, because I thought the main issue was that the reducing suffering, or that the animals in factory farming were experiencing suffering in an extreme way, and that they were living lives and having suffering that was perhaps even outside of the characteristic range of these animals in the wild. And the issue was trying to reduce that suffering. So the idea would be that maybe in the wild they go from negative 20 to positive 20, but in the factory they're at negative 30 or negative 40. I thought it was more about reducing that suffering rather than trying to get them to be able to experience very high degrees of happiness. But the conversation here, the discussion here, sort of looked at the fact that pigs could go from negative 90 to positive 90 and said it might be much more cost effective because they can typically have such big ranges. So let's try to push them towards very positive amounts. I'm a little puzzled by that, but maybe it's me that's confused. Maybe they're saying that, well, the pigs can go from negative 90 to positive 90 very easily because of factory farming. So in fact, we might think that pigs, instead of the chickens, which are typically negative 10, positive 10, that the pigs are, under factory farming, going to be really down in the negative 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and because it was quote-unquote cheap to make them suffer so much, so maybe it's also cheap to put them back towards neutral in common settings. So, you know, maybe it just is a matter of wording here and not of the concept itself. Continuing this section, the features and considerations I explore below are sometimes more relevant to possible range than characteristic range, sometimes more relevant to characteristic range than possible range, and sometimes equally relevant to both. At the level of generality with which I discuss the topic, the distinction is not usually important. However, a more fine-grained and detailed examination of these issues would need to pull apart the effects on possible range from characteristic range. In doing so, we might discover that one type of range is more important or more variable than the other. Small comment here. How could possible range not be more variable than characteristic range? Oh, okay. It could be more variable between species. I get it. It could be hypothetically that species all have similar possible ranges, but very different characteristic ranges, or perhaps the reverse. Yeah. Okay, next section. why variation in the intensity range of valenced experience matters. Theories of welfare agree. Experiences matter, morally, if animals differ in the intensity ranges of their valenced experiences. Such differences could affect the magnitude of welfare changes we create by helping or harming different sorts of animals. Suppose, for instance, the valence intensity of honeybees only vacillates between mildly positive experiences and mildly negative experiences. That is to say, the worst a honeybee might expect to suffer could be the equivalent of a human stubbing her toe. Conversely, the best a honeybee might expect to enjoy could be the equivalent of a human eating a decent banana. In that case, improving the experiential states of honeybees would not generate large improvements in welfare. On the other hand, suppose that the valenced experience of honeybees reach extreme intensities. A typical honeybee pain might be worse than the worst human migraine. A typical honeybee pleasure might be better than the best human orgasm. In that case, improving the experiential states of honeybees could lead to large gains in welfare. Humans exploit an incredibly phylogenetically diverse group of animals. An exponentially greater diversity of animals suffer in the wild, but animal advocates have limited resources. Thus, hard choices must be made. Knowing that we can't help all animals simultaneously, we must choose where to invest our scarce resources. There are, of course, many considerations that must be examined when deciding how to allocate time and money to different groups of animals. But to fully judge interventions and policies, we need to be able to evaluate, at least roughly, welfare gains and losses across many species. Animals differ with respect to their neurobiological makeup, their cognitive and affective complexity, and their experiential capacities. These differences make plausible the idea that there are characteristic differences in the intensity range of valenced experience across species. Moreover, it appears that pain sensitivity varies across humans. Humans exposed to the same sort of stimuli often report different subjective experiences. One review observes, pain perception varies widely among individuals. Even in controlled experimental settings, the same mild nociceptive stimulus can exhibit unpredictably intense sensations in one individual, yet be barely perceived by another. Aside here, I looked up what nociceptive means, and one definition seemed to be having to do with tissue damage. The other seemed a little bit circular in this context and just saying something that can cause pain or pleasure. Continuing the quote, in real-world settings, equally serious injuries often result in remarkably different pain percepts. What drives such dramatic variability of pain perception across individuals remains elusive. Who and Yannetti, 2009. Given such differences among humans, who broadly share social, affective, intellectual, behavioral, and neurobiological characteristics, it's not hard to imagine more profound differences among non-human animals. This possibility is sometimes explicitly raised in the literature. Quote, the apparent occurrence of intraspecific variation in individual the apparent occurrence of intraspecific variation in individuals' pain experiences raises the hypothesis that there might be interspecific variation in individuals' pain experiences. The apparent occurrence of intraspecific raises the possibility that there might be interspecific variation in individuals' pain experiences, i.e., individuals of different species may have different capacities for pain experiences. Yeats, 2012. Next section. How to discern differences in the intensity range of valenced experience. Discerning differences in the intensity range of valenced experiences across species is not easy. As I detail below, the limited evidence currently available suggests extreme uncertainty. Side comment. It's not easy even to consider whether humans have different capacity. And we can, of course, ask humans questions and relate to them in all sorts of ways, so it'll be even more different, presumably, more difficult to make these, or to measure these differences across species. And in this side comment, I'm referring, of course, to some things that I mentioned and discussed in other podcasts about how to measure differences in human happiness. How to discern differences in the intensity range of valenced experiences. A valenced experience. Discerning differences in the intensity range of valenced experience across species is not easy. As I detail below, the limited evidence currently available suggests extreme uncertainty. When researching the topic, I adopted the following three-step methodology, which also serves as a useful conceptual framing for this report. 1. Start with considerations from theoretical evolutionary biology. The evolutionary function of valenced experiences, a valenced experience may place some general constraints on the scope and location of intensity ranges. Thinking about how selection pressures are likely to operate on valenced experience in various conditions may help us identify some rough principles for broad groups of animals. 2. Next, consider how intensity range is likely to vary with characteristics like cognitive sophistication, affective complexity, and sociality. 3. Finally, try to identify various neurobiological and behavioral markers of valenced experience and see how these vary across species. The proxies ought to be validated in humans first, and in the right conditions, extended to some non-human animals. I address these three steps in turn below. Major heading. The evolutionary role of valenced experience. If valenced experiences, pleasures and pains broadly defined, are relatively widespread throughout the animal kingdom, there's probably an evolutionary story that explains why animals with the capacity for valenced experience accrued a fitness advantage over animals without that capacity. The quality and intensity of valenced experience has, like aspects of animal behavior and physiology, been shaped by selection pressures, Browning, 2019. By examining the evolutionary role of valenced experience, we may be able to identify some rough bounds on the likely variation in intensity of valenced experience across species. By taking an evolutionary lens to certain properties, we may even be able to estimate relative differences in the intensity range of valenced experience among some broad groups of animals. According to many evolutionary biologists, valenced experience is adaptive because it motivates fitness-improving actions, Phillips, 2008, and discourages fitness-reducing actions, Dawkins, 2009. Orgasm feels good to iteroparous animals, so those animals are motivated to sexually reproduce. Definition here, iteroparous, I looked this up, means you can reproduce more than once. Tissue damage feels bad, so animals are motivated to avoid physical harm. Juvenile care feels good to altricial animals, so those animals are motivated to ensure the bearers of their genes survive to adulthood. Rotten fruit looks, smells, and tastes bad to some animals, so those animals are motivated to avoid what for them would be unhealthy food, and so on. To motivate fitness-improving actions, valenced experience is thought to play three roles. First, valenced experience represents, in at least a loose sense, fitness-relevant information. Second, valenced experience serves as a common currency for decision-making. Third, valenced experience facilitates learning. Subsection, representation and information gathering. We can think of the felt goodness or badness of an experience as a direct, intrapersonal, within the person, representation of potentially fitness-relevant information. For example, an animal might feel a lance of pain when it moves its injured leg in a certain way. This pain can be thought to represent both a disturbance to the leg, including its location, shape, and quality, and the fact that this sort of disturbance is apt to harm the animal to a certain degree. Cutter and Dye, 2011. This information motivates the animal to rest until the injury has healed. Animals that lack access to such intrapersonal representation are often at a severe fitness disadvantage. For instance, humans with congenital analgesia, a condition that prevents the experience of pain, almost always die young. Pearson Seal, 2016. In many species, valenced experience also induces outward changes that represent fitness-relevant information to observers, especially conspecifics. I looked that up. That's individuals of the same species. The outward signs of disgust after ingesting a poisonous berry warn other members of the species to avoid that food. In social species, such as humans, grunts and winces of pain may elicit offers of assistance. Steinkopf, 2016. In fact, some researchers have theorized that highly social animals suffer characteristically worse pains than non-social animals. For instance, Barbara Finlay and Supriya Sial argue that, quote, over evolutionary time, several stimuli and situations that are painful in neither mammals generally nor in our primate relatives particularly have come to be experienced as pain in humans, accompanied by obvious distress that serves to elicit help from others. In humans, our domesticated species and perhaps other highly social animals, soliciting help may allow survival in otherwise fatal situations. Finley and Sayal, 2014. Reflecting on the representation of valenced experience, especially painful experience, may help us recognize differences in the intensity of valenced experience in certain groups. Predators have evolved to detect evidence of injury in their prey. Predators display a clear preference for injured prey, and this preference can be explained by the fitness benefit of maximizing energy expenditure to consumption efficiency. Butler and Finn, 2009. In response, prey species have evolved mechanisms to minimize the outward expressions of pain that would alert a predator to injury. Minimize the expressions of pain that would alert a predator to injury. McGill, 2009, McLennan, 2018. This feat might have been accomplished in two non-exclusive ways. One, individuals better at hiding their pain might have out-competed conspecifics worse at hiding their pain. Or, two, individuals with a higher pain tolerance may have out-competed conspecifics with lower pain tolerance. If the latter strategy predominated in particular species, we should expect members of that species to experience characteristically less intense pains than members of a comparable species that did not face predation pressures of this kind. Next subsection. Decision making. Another proposed purpose of valenced experience is to serve as a common currency for complex decision making. Ginsberg and Jablonka, 2019. Animals face many competing demands. They must forage for food, avoid predators, care for juveniles, seek reproductive mates, and shelter from environmental hazards. And animals need a process to weigh, say, the fear of predatory attack with the pang of an empty stomach and make the appropriate trade-off. Valenced experiences, as representation of fitness-relevant information, may allow animals to compare and evaluate disparate risks and rewards. Reflecting on the role that valenced experience plays in decision-making may help us put rough bounds on the likely variation in intensity ranges across species. In particular, evolutionary considerations may give us reason to rule out both intensity ranges that are exclusively extraordinarily weak and intensity ranges that are exclusively extraordinarily strong. Some activists, have suggested that animals with relatively simple nervous systems are only capable of extraordinarily weak valenced experiences. For example, Matt Bull writes, quote, "So even if insects can have any subjective experience, their most intense sensation would be the palest hint of a feeling, a tiny fraction of the worst suffering we can experience," end quote. The motivation for this view seems to be the idea that the intensity of an animal's valenced experience should scale with the complexity of the animal's nervous system. However, it's hard to square this idea with the evolutionary function of valenced experience. It's unclear what fitness advantage the palest hint of a feeling could convey. Pain motivates animals to do things like avoid bodily damage. Pleasure motivates animals to do things like reproduce. Subjective experiences so faint as to barely register would do a poor job of motivating anything. One possible reply to this line of argument is to suggest that motivational requirements vary by taxa. Perhaps mammals require intense experience in order to motivate actions, but insects require only weak experiences to motivate similar actions. The thought is plausible if you think that motivation depends on the relative strength of one's experiences, If an insect's experiences are faint, then competition for the insect's motivational resources will not be fierce. So long as the experiences are still ordered by intensity, the insect will be motivated to pursue pleasures at the top end of the scale more than pleasures at the bottom end of the scale, and motivated to avoid pains at the top end of the scale more than pains at the bottom end of the scale. It depends how you think of the scale. I think he means avoid pains at the bottom end or the most extreme end, but that's a minor point there. Here, though, we tread on conceptually precarious ground. If one adopts a subject-relative account of intensity, then it follows that insects do not have characteristically less intense experiences than other animals. So the position must be that insects have objectively faint experiences, but subject-relative motivational requirements. But it's unclear if that is a coherent position. There appears to be some sort of connection between motivation and intensity. Appears where? It would be strange if there were an individual in extreme pain that, all else equal, were not motivated to escape the pain. Conversely, if an individual were extremely motivated to avoid mild pains, such an aversion would, all else equal, be regarded as pathological. The connection between intensity and motivation may not be conceptual, but if the evolutionary function of valenced experience is to motivate actions, it's plausible that intensity and motivation generally co-vary under normal circumstances. Anyone who claims insects have extraordinarily faint experiences faces a dilemma. Either deny that insects are motivated to act, which seems empirically false, or deny the connection between intensity and motivation. One who adopts the latter horn of the dilemma owes us an evolutionary story about how the connection between intensity and motivation was severed. Comment here on one thing that is perhaps somewhat left out of this discussion that I think was also mentioned in some of the comments, which is that it's maybe costly from an energy or evolutionary perspective. It may be costly to develop the whatever it is, hormones or receptors that allow for extreme intensity, pains, and pleasures. That might be costly. So, well, it's and I think it was also mentioned in one of the comments that that maybe that's more costly for, or that that cost requires large organs, or maybe there's economies of scale in producing the organs that can produce that pain or pleasure. So it just might, even though it would be potentially beneficial for an insect to have fairly extreme pains and pleasures, it may not be worth the cost given its limited set of resources. So I think that that needs to be, perhaps maybe that should be considered in this argument. On the other hand, others have speculated that animals with simpler nervous systems have characteristically much more intense experiences than humans. For example, in his blog post, "Is Brain Size Morally Relevant?" Lincoln Post, Brian Tomasik explores the idea that, quote, to a tiny brain, an experience activating just a few pain neurons could feel like the worst thing in the world from its point of view, end quote. Insofar as this notion is plausible, it depends on two ideas. One, that pain intensity depends, at least roughly, on the proportion of total, quote, pain neurons that are firing at a given time. And two, that small brains are more likely to have a total perception of their pain neurons firing at once. That small brains are more likely to have a total proportion of their pain neurons firing at once. As far as I can tell, there is little experience to support either one or two. Comment here, I would just like a little bit of justification for the lack of empirical evidence here, what was searched, what was looked for. and what was found in the reading. Moreover, there may be theoretical reasons to regard this notion with suspicion. There appears to be a limit to how intense experiences can be before they lose the fitness advantage for which they were selected in the first place. In humans, the conscious sensation of pain is distracting. Chan et al., 2012. Mild pain can be an annoyance, and intense pain can be so overwhelming that it effectively incapacitates the sufferer. A similar story is probably true of pleasures. If an animal's experiences were exclusively extremely strong, it seems the animal's decision-making would be impaired. Just putting in perspective, the first evolutionary role was representation and information gathering. The injured leg thing confused me a little bit because that example felt a little bit more like the decision-making and the common currency one. But I guess what's meant is that representation is that pain and pleasure help tell me and also tell other people, tell my allies, my family, my genetic kin, whether to do something or avoid something, and also tell me whether to do something or avoid something. Perhaps it's like the price signal in the classical economic models, or at least the direction of that. Not sure. And then decision making seems kind of similar, but then he talks about the idea that more pain or more pleasure could indicate a more important thing to do or more important thing to avoid, to know how to really weigh these things. But those two do seem like birds of the same feather. I'm not 100% sure so far on the distinction between those two. So maybe that could be made a little more clear. Third subsection of under evolutionary roles. So we had our information gathering, decision making, and now we have learning. It seems that one of the most important evolutionary functions of valenced experience is to facilitate learning. Damasio and Carvalho, 2013. Behaviors which improve evolutionary fitness, such as mating, tend to have a positive valence, while behaviors which reduce evolutionary fitness, such as eating spoiled meat, tend to have a negative valence. When these valences are paired with the appropriate behaviors often enough, an animal learns to pursue fitness-boosting behaviors and avoid fitness-reducing behaviors. Lynn Sneddon and her collaborators argue that the, quote, key function of pain appears to be that the aversive experience of pain creates a strong and lasting motivation that enables the animal to avoid getting into a similar situation in the future. Sneddon et al., 2014. Animals less likely to benefit from long-term learning may be less likely to benefit from valenced experiences. This idea has led some researchers to speculate that animals with a shorter lifespan are less sensitive to pain than animals with a longer lifespan. Walters, 2018. The basic idea is that the reproduction survival trade-off will push some animals to occupy an evolutionary niche that favors traits that increase early reproductive success, even at the expense of traits that promote long-term survival. Stearns, 2012. One important function of painful experiences is to teach an animal which stimuli to avoid in order to promote long-term survival. Short-lived animals that won't be around long enough to benefit from such learning may be unlikely to invest in costly, fine-grained, nociceptive systems. Finley, 2019. These animals would still benefit from a nociceptive system that alerted animals to the threat of imminent death, but they would be less likely to benefit from a system that, say, induced an unpleasant sensation when the animals ate food that were only slightly bad for them. Okay, I can see how that could get at the gradations, but what does that have to tell me about the range? Similar reasoning may be applied to animals, again, like many insects, that produce large numbers of offspring that don't survive to adulthood and that change drastically between life stages. If most individuals in the larval or pupal stage are likely to benefit less from valenced experience than adult members of this species, then the intensity range of adults might be characteristically larger than the range for juveniles. This consideration may be especially important for invertebrate species welfare prioritization. Some invertebrate species, such as mealworms and black soldier flies, are slaughtered before they reach adulthood. Other species, such as crickets, are farmed to adulthood. However, recent research suggests, or perhaps merely assumes, that fruit fly larvae process noxious stimuli in the same way as adult flies. Lopez Belito et al., 2019. Comment here. I think it's important to know whether it's the assumes or it's actually has evidence. Finally, the didactic role of valenced experience may make differences in the subjective experiences of time. It may make differences in the subjective experience of time, which links one of the other posts in the series, relevant to differences in the intensity of valenced experience. Suppose it's the case that for some range of values, X seconds of valenced experience at intensity N is as effective a teaching tool as 2x seconds of valenced experience at experience 0.5n. If animal A has a rate of subjective experience, linked again, twice that of animal B, A could learn the same lesson as B in either half the time or half the cognitive sophistication and intensity of valenced experience. There are two ways in which an animal's degree of cognitive sophistication could plausibly affect the intensity range of its valenced experiences. Certain types of cognitive sophistication may directly alter valenced states, amplifying or diminishing the intensity of certain pains and pleasures. Other types of cognitive sophistication may alter intensity range by unlocking new states that characteristically accompany certain pains and pleasures, the combination of which serves to reduce or magnify the overall intensity of the combined experiences. As we'll see below, the means by which an animal's level of cognitive sophistication affects its experiences do not all cut in the same direction. Some types of cognitive sophistication appear to increase intensity range, while other types of cognitive sophistication appear to decrease intensity range. The primary reason for this tension is that, as I hope is independently plausible, cognitive sophistication is not a single unidimensional characteristic. Instead, the thing we sometimes nebulously refer to as cognitive sophistication is actually a loose, heterogeneous bundle of independent traits. These various traits affect the intensity of valenced experience in various ways. Thus, the claim that cognitive sophistication affects the intensity of valenced experience, while true, is conceptually too simple for our purposes. We need a more fine-grained analysis that recognizes the different ways that different elements of cognitive sophistication are apt to influence the intensity of valenced experience. A further complication is that different elements of cognitive sophistication may affect different types of valenced experience in different ways. The multitude of relationships between different elements of cognitive sophistication and different types of valenced experience makes for a complicated web of effects, Yates, 2012. Great care must be taken to untangle this web. We should thus be wary of claims that report a clear and general relationship between the intensity of valenced experience and cognitive sophistication. Subsection: Mental Time Travel. The capacity to remember past events and imagine future events may influence the intensity of valenced experiences. Psychologists call this ability mental time travel. Evidence of mental time travel is currently limited to birds and mammals. Check out. Though any attribution of the ability to non-human animals is at least somewhat controversial. Like many of the other cognitive traits discussed in this section, mental time travel seems to reduce the intensity of experiences in some circumstances and amplify the intensity of experiences in other circumstances. It is thus unclear whether animals that possess this ability have characteristically more or less intense valenced experiences overall. For animals experiencing acute pain with a fixed endpoint, mental time travel may reduce the intensity of pain. Sahar Akhtar writes, "Greater time horizons in either direction might lessen the intensity of one's pain. Being able to think about the past can allow us to recollect and take comfort in painless past experiences. Similarly, by thinking about future periods, we may be able to take relief in the thought of future periods without pain, and we are capable of recognizing that the pain will end. An animal may not be able to remember times without pain, or imagine future periods without the pain." Akhtar, 2011. In addition to remembering pain-free moments in the past, if the current painful experience is of a type that an animal has undergone in the past, reflecting on that past painful experience may diminish the intensity of the current experience. In humans, familiarity with a pain reduces the intensity of the pain, Reichertz et al., 2017. And it's plausible that non-human animals with sufficient memorial skills experience a similar reduction in intensity. Animals unable to become familiar with a repeated painful stimulus may experience the pain at its peak intensity every time. Akhtar concludes that animals that have a limited temporal sense would seem to be unable to escape or get outside of their present mental state, including a present painful state. Akhtar, 2011. On the other hand, the ability to recall past suffering and anticipate future suffering adds an additional dimension to experience. Some authors have thus argued that mental time travel increases rather than decreases the intensity range of valenced experience. Hoob Brouwer and Willem van der Dijl write, Also, while animals, especially lower animals, such as mice and rattlesnakes, might not be capable of experiencing as high level a well-being as humans, they might also not have the capacity to suffer as much as humans can. One reason to think that this is so is that humans can remember past suffering and anticipate future suffering to a much greater extent than, for example, mice and rattlesnakes can. Brower and van der Dijl, 2020. In humans, the anticipation of certain, especially psychological, stressors can induce anxiety-driven hyperalgesia, enhanced pain sensitivity. Reichertz et al., 2017. James Yates summarizes the dual nature of mental time travel thusly. The ability to temporarily locate pain allows animals to know when pain will begin or end, and that pain will begin, end, or continue. The latter knowledge may help animals to cope, and higher animals that are able to anticipate pain's end may therefore find pain experiences less unpleasant. Conversely, higher animals' knowledge that pain is likely to continue may exacerbate their negative feelings. Yates, 2012. Whether mental time travel increases or decreases the intensity of experience may depend on how fully developed the ability is in a given animal. Akhtar speculates that beings with only a basic or rudimentary sense of time and of self may be at the greatest disadvantage from pain. They may possess enough self and time awareness to suffer from the anticipation and memory of pain, but not enough to be able to discount pain, choosing to refrain from focusing on pain, form expectations about the cessation of pain, or to consider other interests or times without pain. Akhtar, 2011. It's unclear which animals fall into this category, but it plausibly encompasses many bird and non-human mammal species. Next subheading. Rationalization and normative reasoning. An aside, these were going through the different ways in which cognitive sophistication may relate to and impact the intensity of valenced experiences. So we did mental time travel. Now we're going to do the next section, rationalization and normative reasoning. The ability to rationalize valenced experiences may reduce their intensity. When one understands that the pain one endures is suffered for good cause, the fatigue of exercise or the prick of a flu shot, say, it's plausible that the overall experience is less intense than comparable stimuli endured for no good cause. Rationalization may reduce the overall intensity of negative experience by removing other negative states. A dog receiving a parvovirus vaccination might feel alarm and betrayal that their best friend would subject them to such discomfort, whereas a human undergoing a similar procedure might only feel the physical pain of the shot. Alternatively, and non-exclusively, rationalization might reduce the overall intensity of negative experiences by introducing positively valenced states that counteract the negative state. Although a human might dislike the nature of a painful medical procedure, she might find solace in the fact that the procedure improves her health. Donald Broom argues that more sophisticated brain processing will also help provide better opportunities for coping with some problems. For example, humans may have means of dealing with pain that fish do not, and may suffer less from the pain because they're able to rationalize that it will not last for long. Broom, 2007. Sahar Akhtar adds, without the belief that there are good reasons to endure their pain, even if there are good reasons, such as a painful but necessary veterinary procedure, animal pain would likely be more intense. Akhtar, 2011. On the other hand, the ability to recognize good reasons for an experience is probably a manifestation of a more general capacity to reason normatively about the world. In some circumstances, this capacity appears to increase rather than diminish the intensity of experience. For example, witnessing or undergoing an event that one recognizes as unjust adds a moral dimension to the experience, and adding a moral dimension to an experience plausibly amplifies the intensity of the experience. Recent research suggests that pains perceived to be unjust or unfair are judged to be more severe. McPartland and Eccleston, 2013. Though a causal explanation of the correlation has yet to be established, still, it's plausible that pains and pleasures perceived to be undeserved might feel worse, all things considered, than comparably evoked pains and pleasures without a normative component. Pains and pleasures perceived to be deserved might feel better, all things considered. Sorry, I just said that. If this is true, then all else equal, creatures capable of forming normative judgments will possess a wider characteristic intensity range than creatures incapable of forming such judgments. It's unclear whether non-human animals are capable of normative reasoning. For recent discussion of the question, see Clement, 2013, Johansson, 2019, and Andrews, 2020. Next subheading, attention and focus. The ability to consciously direct one's attention and focus may affect the intensity of the valence experience. Small comment here. I'm just noticing that there's a little bit more of a focus, at least in the discussion here, of cognitive, of the impact of cognitive sophistication on the range of intensity of valence experiences. There's a little bit more focus on the negative part of it here, which I think is appropriate, but he didn't explicitly say, I'm going to focus on the negative part of it. Why do I think it's appropriate? Because we're probably mainly concerned with things like reducing farmed animal pain and not enhancing their pleasure. But if you remember, he's been and seems to continue to be focusing on how cognitive sophistication may make pain worse or better, rather than thinking about how it makes pleasure more or less pleasurable. For example, he mentioned how being able to mentally time travel and note that this pain will not last forever may make it less painful, but anticipating it may make it actually more painful. Continuing with attention and focus. The ability to consciously direct one's attention and focus may affect the intensity of valenced experience. Because valenced experiences evolved to make fitness-relevant information salient, they tend to grab our attention. Bihajic et al., 2018. Many animals seem to lack the ability to deliberately redirect their attention and focus away from valenced experiences. And this inability may increase the intensity of the experiences. James Yates speculates that, quote, animals more able to divide attention would experience pain of lower intensity because the attention is divided. Yates, 2012. Sahar Akhtar concurs, writing, the facts, if they are facts, that many animals do not have many substitutes for focusing on their pain and cannot will themselves to focus on other things, cannot form expectations about the ending of pain, think about other times without pain, or consider more complex interests for which pain may be a necessary means, provides us with reasons for thinking that the overall pain experience caused by a given measure of pain might sometimes be worse for animals than it is for us. Akhtar 2011. Small side comment here. This does seem to have quite a bit of overlap with the previous classification, with some of the previous classifications. In particular, time travel has been specified as a means for redirecting one's attention and focus, redirecting it, even as was just mentioned, towards the idea that the pain may cease or that there may be times without pain. So the categorization has a bit more overlap than I would like, but that's not a major critique, of course. Although Yeats and Akhtar appear to base their reasoning on a priori considerations, there is at least modest empirical evidence to support their position. Cognitive inhibition is the ability to disregard stimuli that are irrelevant to the task at hand. Recent research suggests that in humans, a higher level of cognitive inhibition is associated with lower a higher level of cognitive inhibition is associated with lower experimental pain sensitivity. Bjedzic et al., 2018. Hence, it appears that humans that are better able to consciously redirect their focus also suffer characteristically less intense pains. Just an aside here, a lot of this sort of seems to fall under pretty obvious things that, you know, probably didn't need a study, but maybe it's also nice to have strong evidence, solid evidence for something that's very, very intuitive. The extent to which non-human animals can consciously control their attention is unclear. Non-human primates are generally thought to be able to redirect their focus non-reflexively. Scarif, Gomez, and Byrne, 2004. And recent research suggests rodents may also possess this ability. Matzel, Was, and Colata, 2011, Lustig et al., 2013. It appears this ability has not been widely studied in other non-human animals. Just a sort of stylistic or writing comment here. You haven't explained, I'm not sure what it means to redirect one's focus non-reflexively. Does that mean to do so consciously? Does that mean not at one, to redirect it at others than oneself? I'm not sure. Does it literally mean what was in the previous sentence, which is consciously control their attention? If it's literally the same, that should be made clear. Could say i.e. or just use the same phrase. Otherwise, would be helpful to define some of these non-commonly expressed terms. Next subhead, learning ability. As noted above, one of the main evolutionary functions of valenced experiences is to facilitate the learning of fitness-improving behaviors. Pain teaches animals which stimuli are noxious, how to avoid those stimuli, and what to do to recover from injury. Pleasure teaches animals which foods are healthy and which activities increase the likelihood of gene propagation. Because extremely intense experiences are often distracting, animals that undergo characteristically extremely intense experiences appear to be at a selective disadvantage compared to conspecifics with less intense experiences. Thus, we might expect evolution to select for animals with experiences just intense enough, in general, to play the primary instructive role of pleasure and pain. Animals differ with respect to the ease with which they're able to learn new information. In controlled settings, some species can be taught a new behavior in fewer trials than other species. The potential complexity of learned behavior also varies by species. Some types of animals appear better equipped to pick up patterns in signals only weakly conveyed. In general, less cognitively sophisticated animals probably require stronger signals for pattern learning. If valenced experience is the signal, then we might reasonably expect the intensity of valenced experience to correlate inversely with learning ability. That is, all else equal, the better an animal is at learning, the less intense its valenced experience might normally be. This line of reasoning is, however, extremely speculative. It's possible learning depends more on the statistical regularity of the pattern than the strength of the stimulus during trials, in which case we should not expect a relationship between learning experience, we should not expect a relationship between learning ability and the intensity of valenced experience. Let me just repeat that. He's saying that learning might depend more on the regularity of the pattern than the strength of the stimulus or than the intensity of it. So therefore, it shouldn't be that animals that are worse at learning need stronger stimuli or need greater differences between the best and the worst. Next subsection. Just remembering, we're talking about the ways in which cognitive complexity might be expected to lead to greater or lesser differences in the intensity of valence, range of intensity of valence experiences. Self-awareness. Self-awareness may influence the intensity of valenced experience. However, like many of the features described above, the direction of this influence is unclear. Some authors emphasize the ways self-awareness may unlock new states that increase intensity range. For instance, Gregory Burns writes, "An animal who is aware of his or her own pain and suffering may well experience the existential fear associated with imminent death." Burns, 2017. If self-awareness is a necessary condition on existential fear, and existential fear is one of the worst possible experiences, then all else equal, it seems self-awareness extends both an animal's possible intensity range of experience and, if existential fear is common enough, an animal's characteristic intensity range. However, other authors have suggested that the lack of self-awareness increases the intensity of valenced experience. Sahar Akhtar argues that the absence of self and time awareness may mean that the feeling of pain for animals is much worse in certain respects than has previously been thought. The absence of awareness may mean that in some cases pain is worse for animals than a comparable measure of pain for us. Akhtar, 2011. Akhtar's argument for this claim proceeds by way of mental time travel, for which she takes self-awareness to be a necessary condition. She writes, "Animals without an awareness of self and time may not be able to anticipate the cessation of the pain or take relief in the thought that it may or will end." Akhtar, 2011. Minor stylistic comment here. This is again repeating the mental time travel. Probably didn't need to recapitulate it. Of course, what exactly constitutes self-awareness is also contentious. There is a philosophical tradition, dating back at least to Kant, that claims sophisticated language ability is the only hallmark of true self-awareness. More recently, empirical evidence has suggested that many non-human animals appear to be self-aware. Wada et al., 2016. There is even controversial evidence for self-awareness in cleaner ras, a species of bony fish. Coda et al., 2019. If metacognition is a type of self-awareness, then self-awareness is probably even more widespread. I guess that metacognition is thinking about thinking. There is evidence of uncertainty monitoring, a type of metacognition, in bees, Perry and Bacon, 2013, and ants, Chakas and Hines, 2015. Next subhead, doxastic capacity. A creature's doxastic capacity, I may be totally mispronouncing that, Reverse refers to its ability to adopt doxastic attitudes, canonically belief, disbelief, and suspension of judgment towards various propositions. There's a lot of words out there I never knew existed. Some animals have a wide range of beliefs concerning a large variety of topics. Other animals have a limited set of beliefs concerning a narrow range. An ability to form beliefs about one's valenced experiences may influence the intensity of those experiences. James Yates writes, insofar as pain is, quote, information, an animal's doxastic reasoning abilities can affect how it processes painful stimuli. Higher animals may entertain beliefs about a pain's cause, duration, permanence, and the animal's ability to control it. Yates, 2012. This ability, however, may cut both ways. Knowing that a pain to come will be fleeting plausibly reduces the intensity of the pain. Animals that are unable to form such beliefs may suffer more from comparable stimuli. Compare a routine medical procedure for humans with a routine veterinary procedure for dogs. On the other hand, knowing that, say, a migraine could strike at any moment induces a dread that would be absent if one were unable to entertain beliefs about future pain states. Yates summarizes the relationship thusly. Higher doxastic capabilities may be beneficial for animals who experience predictable, controllable, and impermanent pain, whereas animals experiencing pain that appears unpredictable, uncontrollable, and permanent may suffer more from knowing about this. Yates, 2012. Another comment, kind of the same comment, but a lot of this seems to be going through the capacity for mental time travel, and maybe there was a way of discussing this. I mean, the channel by which a lot of this, whether certain capability increases or decreases the intensity range of valence experiences, a lot of that seems to be going through the channel of, does that capacity enable mental time travel? I don't see, when you're referring to that, one could just put a little link of sorts to, remember, as we discussed mental time travel, this is another thing that would enable mental time travel or make mental time travel more likely, which we discussed in the prior section, rather than coming up with the example again with the importance of mental time travel and how it could make it easier for you to know this too shall pass, but then also to fret about what's coming or re-experience what you've had pain about. You know, that you don't need to state that every single time. It's not just that it makes the essay longer and makes and longer to read, but I think for me at least, it causes me as the reader to question, wait, didn't they already say that? But if they did, why are they saying it again? Is there something different that I'm not getting that appears to be the same to me, but maybe I'm failing to appreciate some distinction? And maybe I am failing to appreciate some distinction, but if so, that distinction should perhaps be made more clear.
Just like the many other fussy, nitpicky comments that can be found in the Streus. Will effective complexity impact the intensity of valenced experience? Can we measure the intensity of valenced experience in neurobiological, behavioral, and physiological markers? Will there be a conclusion? Find out next week, true believers, right here on
Found in the Streus.